You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Satan, your kingdom must come down. Satan, your kingdom must come down. I heard the voice of Jesus say, Satan, your kingdom must come down.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me once again for another episode of the Sectarian Review Podcast. As always, my name is Danny Anderson. I want to thank once again the Blind Revelators for letting me use their song, their cover of Satan, Your Kingdom Must Come Down. It's kind of a nice choice for today. Today we're actually going to be talking about a work of poetry by a now regular on the show, C. Derek Varn, who's been on the show several times now, usually to talk about politics and particularly bringing his leftist perspective to what we do here. But Derek is also a poet, and he has a new book out called Apocalyptics, and it's published by Unlikely Books. And I'm going to put a link to the page on the publisher website to this book so you can go out and buy it. There's no expectation of partiality here. I really enjoy this book and I like Derek. And so I'm a big fan. So I'm going to encourage you to go out and buy the book. I think you'll enjoy it. And we're going to talk to Derek today. I'm sure we'll get into politics, but primarily it's going to be through the lens of his work as a poet. Derek, how are you doing today?
I'm fine.
Great. So let me ask you, I know that you're on podcasts pretty much all the time, 24/7. You can find Derek Varn on a podcast somewhere. How often do you get to talk about this aspect of your life and work?
Oh God, not enough. hardly ever, honestly. I've done one podcast on it for Zero Books, but it's actually very funny because I know a ton about history. I know a ton about a lot of things, but the two things I actually do for a living hardly ever come up on podcast discussions. So, I'm a teacher and I am a poet, and I rarely get to talk about that. So,
we're going to address that partially today. And hey, heck, we might have a show about pedagogy down the road, and we can bring you into that conversation as well. You're obviously the true Renaissance man, and I'm very excited to talk to you about this book of poetry. And so let's kind of jump right into it. You say you are a poet as well as a teacher. What is your sort of history as a poet? How long have you been doing this? What places have you published?
So I've published at JMWW. I published at Unlikely Stories, whose press is actually who put out this book. And I've been publishing at Unlikely periodically for almost as of this summer, 20 years. Mm. I started publishing poetry at about 18 years old. I'm 38 now, so I've done it a while. I have an MFA in poetry in specific, so it's actually what I'm formally trained in probably the most. I am mostly published in magazines, a couple of anthologies, some anthologies about – there's a most recent anthology was Goodbye Mexico. I've also ironically published in a Gen X anthology, even though I don't think I am technically a Gen Xer, which is interesting.
You're right on the cusp, I think.
I mean, at the time they were defining Gen X as ending in 1982. So, but now it's actually changed. So who knows?
Yeah.
And also at the time it was like Gen X is young and hip and it's defining itself. And now it's like, we old.
Yeah, we're the Vox crowd now. Yeah.
I think I've published something like 75 poems in magazines somewhere. This book has been a long time coming. It was actually my MFA thesis, but it was not like, I think, only about 30% of what's in the book is from that original draft of the book. And it was not called Apocalyptics. initially. In fact, the original title for this book, even when it was accepted by the publisher, was Subtitled Gray Bodies, but I was told that was too depressing.
Wait, repeat the title. Repeat the original title again. I didn't quite catch it. What was
sometimes it? It's actually the central poem of the book. If you actually like find the dead center of the book, you will find this long, multifaceted, weird.
Sometimes gray poem. Bodies. Yes.
Yeah, that was the title of the book originally, and that's why it's in the center. But I was told that was too depressing, so I picked the next most appropriate title, which is Apocalyptic, which is another poem in the book.
Yeah. And so the apocalypse is less depressing to the publisher than Sometimes Gray Bodies. Okay.
Yeah. There's kind of a lot of cynicism in it. They were thinking the apocalypse with all the Trump administration. This book was accepted in 2016.
I see, yes.
So they're like, oh, everybody won't buy it because, you know, everything's scary right now. And I find it funny.
Yeah.
Well,
can I ask you a question about your sort of background then? This doesn't strike me as overly academic in its style, the poetry in this book. And so, I mean, it was interesting to me.
It's funny because I've been called a poet's poet by my thesis advisor, believe it or not. But because I was told I'm not that accessible.
I have to admit to both you and to the listener that I am not sort of an expert on poetry. I'm an English professor. Poetry is not a super strong suit of mine, particularly. I kind of read poetry as just sort of an amateur. I don't consider myself a professional reader of poetry very nicely. When I read someone like Mary Carr, for example, her poetry is like super accessible. Your poetry is not necessarily that accessible, but it isn't like T.S. Eliot difficult either. And so it's interesting to me that this was filtered through the MFA system. And I find that to be, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the MFA system my thoughts on the MFA are complicated. One, it was partially funded by the precursor to the CIA as a thing. The true story, Iowa was actually partly an anti-communist project. Seriously.
Yeah.
Which I think the Atlantic actually has broke recently, but it's something I've known for a while. The work of Alfield Rice, who wrote a long book on anti-communist modernism and also anti-modernism from anti-communists, which is weird because they were both seen as anti-communists. It's really funny. A lot of people opposed avant-garde art because it was too communistic while it was being funded by the CIA to fight communism. It's really kind of funny.
Yeah. That's also an interesting continuation of the exploration that Mark McGurl started with his great book, I think, on the program era, which is an exploration of basically the Iowa workshop and some of the stuff. It's kind of a Foucauldian reading of that. And so this is an interesting addition to that.
So as far as my background, I started publishing poetry way before I went into the MFA. And the MFA was actually an afterthought. I thought I was going to be a lawyer. And if you look at my undergrad degrees, they actually make more sense for a law. I have a straight English literature degree, but I have a pretty strong supplementary in philosophy and anthropology, and the philosophy was set for the LSAT. Mm. My thesis advisor, Martin Lamon, who used to be the head of the AWP, he started the MFA at the school I went to, which is Georgia College, and I was one of their – I think I was part of their like third or fourth graduating class early on. And I was considered the most avant-garde poet there. Hmm. So, which is interesting because I don't think I'm a particularly academic poet, although I've been told the breadth of reference you kind of have to have to read me is kind of a lot. I think the idea that the MFAs produce a lot of like academic poetry is kind of a myth.
Mm.
They're much more likely to produce a Mary Carr or Kay Ryan than they are. Iowa is the exception actually to that. Iowa's and maybe maybe Colorado. But in general, I think they actually kind of produce kind of accessible work, although that's changed too, because the hybrid poetics movement has been a thing for a while now. That anthology came out, I think it was called Hybrid Poetry. The anthology came out in the mid-aughts, which was, its argument was that there is a new generation of like Gen X and millennial poets who didn't really recognize the avant-garde mainstream distinction. And I kind of see myself in that vein.
I see. Okay.
So I pull from, like, there's a lot of avant-garde influences, but there's also a lot of formal poetic influences. I would consider myself a neo-modernist more than a postmodernist, you know, that sort of thing. But
like sort of Philip Larkin-y kind of?
And I would, no. Well, sort of. I would, if you took Philip Larkin and took the poet Bim Ramke, used to teach at University of Colorado, I would be like somewhere in between. So if you took a very avant-garde poet and you take a kind of traditional classicist sort of like dry formal poet like Larkin, who's very, and dry here I don't mean as an insult, I mean it's like dry humor.
Yeah.
Very subtle. But very accessible seeming on first read, I aim to split this difference.
Okay.
Between those two kinds of poetry. But you know, people ask me like, who do you write for? I don't write for anybody, honestly. Like I really don't have an intended audience in mind when I write. I write in long cycles. I take a very long time to produce a book. I have four or five books on the back burner at a time, actually. And at any given time, I'll have 50 to 60 poems in circulation to magazines. So like, you know, and if anyone follows my Facebook, they know, even though I'm mostly known for starting fights about politics, that I'll publish two or three or four poems to my Facebook feed in rough draft a week.
Yeah. Well, and you tag, I know you personally tag me in quite a lot of those, and I enjoy reading those. and so those are things that are meant to be, do you consider us, those folks that you tag in these poems, kind of early reviewers?
It's a cross section. Yeah. It's a cross section. If I pick people who I would consider not necessarily like poets, actually, because I don't want to write for other poets, but I pick people who I would consider sort of like, if at least half these people don't get something out of this, this poem either needs to be reworked or isn't going anywhere. Because, like I said, I don't write them for any particular audience, but I do need somebody to get them. And so, like, if an audience doesn't respond to it, it's dead on arrival.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Can I ask you, so that's just in terms of a process, that's really open and public. And so, I mean, you don't have any, that's rather fearless, I think. I when I write something, I'm sort of trepidatious and embarrassed almost to ask a single person to give me feedback privately about it, right? And I don't write typically fiction. This is just essays that I write. So the personal work like poetry, that's very brave of you to just throw it out there publicly in draft form.
You know what? I got fearless after my MFA. When I got out of my MFA, actually, I was so tired of author shenanigans that I actually didn't write anything probably for about 2 years. I mean, I was like shopping the stuff I wrote when I was in my MFA program, and then I just sort of stopped. I ended up being a public school teacher for, well, I still kind of am now, but like I was a inner city South public school teacher for a while, and I just didn't do anything with the arts for a while.
Yeah.
And then I got back into it, and I was like, you know, when I was publishing in journals even back then, but I noticed like when I published online, I get feedback, even if it was an online journal. If I published it in a physical journal, even if it was a fairly reputable one, I didn't know if anyone ever saw that.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly opaque process, and like, you know, I subscribe to a number of poetry journals, but outside of the biggest ones, I don't know that a lot of people read them except to pad out their CV, which is this weird sort of system. So I started like thinking like, okay, I can reach out on the internet. I don't want to make it completely public. Like I don't put drafts up on a public blog, A, because I couldn't publish those poems, but to groups in a shut off environment, but fairly publicly to that environment. Yeah, I just sort of just decided, you know, it's fine. But I'm also not afraid of criticism. It's one of the only good things. There's a lot of problems with the MFA system. One of the things that it does is workshops tend to somewhat homogenize taste based on the selection of the people in them, which is going to be dominated by the aesthetic criterion of your school.
Mm-hmm.
But it does make you fearless in the sense that you get pretty much over, like, if something, you know, if people don't like this, then welcome.
Yeah.
Sorry, you can't have that on the air. Oh.
I've got a week to bleep that one. Don't even worry about it. Yeah, it's okay.
So
1621, he says, F them. All right.
I forget I'm on Christian podcasts. I'm used to being pretty boring.
Actually, the last time you swore on my podcast, I actually got a note of thanks on Twitter. People thought we should have more swearing on the show. So,
so you're not that stodgy, your Christian audience.
I don't think my audiences or me are very sensitive in many ways. So, yeah, go ahead.
But I don't want you to have to put an explicit tag on your podcast for that one. I can
bleep that one. It's fine.
So that's a large part of my process. And the other thing is I have been told that my, you know, even by other authors and people who are fairly well educated, that the frame of reference required for my poetry is really large. But as I tell people a lot of the time, you don't have to get everything in a poem to enjoy it. In fact, sure, you shouldn't. And when I teach poetry, that's the first thing I tell students is don't try to understand it first.
Yeah.
Like, let it wash over you in language like music first, and then you can piece it out. And so I think that sort of musical concern, which I try to really keep into my process, is part of why the kind of obliqueness of reference and stuff. I try to use accessibility and rhythm and in the immediacy of images to ground things that are otherwise very alienating. And and I'll jump an obscene, even in the same poem I might reference like Jewish mystical thought, 80s punk rock.
There was an Iggy Pop reference in there somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like there's actually more references than most people know. I mean, that's one of the things but the point of that is that the references should not, if you don't get the reference, you shouldn't be cut out of the meaning of the poem entirely.
Yeah.
And that's something that I try to revise for. And that's a part of why I have that public process for my drafting, is if there's something that if nobody gets it, or if it stands out that they don't get it, like if they can't follow the poem, even if they don't get the reference, then we have to work on the poem.
Yeah.
And
do you revise pretty heavily?
Yeah, and I revise over a long period of time. So, like, you might see a draft of a poem that I put out for a group. I usually write those really fast, so they can come out, like, in, they can come out, like, within 15 minutes to 24 hours after I do the first or second draft.
Mm.
But the second and third draft of a poem you might not see for 2 or 3 years. Because there's a couple reasons for that. One, I'm personally dyslexic and aphasic, which is an interesting thing for a poet to be. And I'm a synesthesiac. So I got all kinds of neuroatypical, as the hip kids say, and going on there. And how I handle that in my writing process is actually just time.
Mm.
So I draft quickly and revise very, very slowly, because I don't necessarily, like, sometimes the poem is missing things that I thought were in it just because it didn't get down on paper for reasons that have nothing to do with the poem itself. It's a little bit easier with formal poetry because formal poetry kind of either clicks or it doesn't. Revising formal poetry is hard. And so I tend to suspect it in the past poetry revision, and I actually kind of know this actually from looking up, from doing a lot of scholarly work on poetry. Poetry revision was not as big of a thing because you would have to work so hard to get those lines to work in the first place that it wasn't quite as necessary as with free verse poetry. But anyway, but yeah, generally a poem will go through a series of like 2 to 15 drafts, and that those drafts will be spaced out over 2 or 3 years. So like in my office right now, I'm literally looking at a stack of 400 poems that I'm going back through that have been written over the past 5 years that haven't been published yet. And I'm also bad about like, until something's in a book, even if I published it, I don't know, on a magazine, I will still rewrite it. Only putting in it, only when it's in a full book do I stop. Does it freeze?
You're like Wordsworth.
Yeah, once it's in a book, I'm done. I'm not doing that whole like, well, the revised new standard of this book will have 15, you know, like a different version of this.
Sure, yeah.
But I rewrite things for years and years and years after I write them originally. And like I said, this book, the oldest poem in this book was written in 1999, actually, huh. And the newest poem was written in 2015.
Huh.
So. There's a huge range of years invested in some of these poems.
Also like George Lucas, I guess. You're still tinkering with your original genius, right? So a few minutes ago, you mentioned sort of the imagistic quality of this poetry. And I think I totally can see that. It is each stanza creates sort of an image in your head, and you're, I think, exactly right to say that you don't necessarily have to get all the references. There was one reference to Stendhal in here about beauty and whatnot, and I sort of remembered it, but I had to go back and look it up later, right? But I got the point, right? And so, speaking of images, before we kind of move into the meat of the book itself, can we talk a little bit about the cover? Because it's a very kind of, I think it matches that aspect of your poetry. I mean, it's a very imagistic cover. Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah. So my publisher, John Penton, at almost at Zero Books, that's my employer. No, Unlikely Press. Sent me a series. He gave me two artists that he thought would be good for me. One of the artists, actually, Adrian Kenyon, is a British, I believe, British artist living in France. He did a series of collages for Unlikely Stories 10 years ago, when I was the art, and I was the art editor for there for about a year. Like, I had nothing to do with the poetry. Actually, I was picking on art, and these collages really stood out in my mind. And when his name came up as a possible artist, I was like, I kind of want that. And there's another series of pictures that I was considering that were like, Marxist militant things painted on churches.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up going with this, Adrian let me use it. But now the interesting thing about the cover is this is not the cover I picked.
Oh, it's interesting. Okay. Because it weirdly, it fits very well. And so it's.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the difference. The original actually fit better. And I'm not saying that to disparage my publisher. So the original collage is hanging up on my wall, and it is almost identical to the one you're looking at, except the key figure in it is not Trump, but George Bush, and the person pouring the gasoline on the fire,
okay,
is not Kim Jong-un, it's Osama bin Laden.
I see, okay.
And the reason why that was more appropriate is the Iraq War comes up a lot because I wrote these over the basically from 1999 to 2000, and most of these were written by 2015.
Yeah.
Well,
in the poem itself, the title track, if you will, it references the Twin Towers and 9/11, yeah. Right? And so that actually makes a lot of sense.
So, but they updated this to the artist actually did this. The artist updated it to Trump. And the publisher decided to go with the Trump version because partly cynically out of sales, but also like because he wanted to, this is how he justified it to me other than sales. He wanted to show that the Bush era poems were actually more relevant now that we were in Trump's America than they would have been in Obama's.
Mm.
Now, I find that interesting because, I'm a very political person, obviously, but I would actually say I'm a political, I'm a political poet, but I'm not a political poet in the obvious way. I hate didactic poetry.
Right.
And I will reference explicit political things in it, but I don't write poetry directly about politics. And this picture evoked the like conflation of a politics and apocalypticism that I thought was kind of the background to a lot of these poems. So like there's a way in which the news is used in my poetry where it is treated as sort of a hum of low-grade trauma that is always going on and kind of interrupting in onto daily life.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought this sort of captured, even though it's front and center, really, really well. And so I wrote the artist, and my publisher wrote the artist, and the artist was kind enough not only to let me use his collage for the book, but also he actually gave me the series of collages. They're now on my wall. So I was super, super excited. He's a really good artist. And I was really happy to have the book. And then when Jonathan and I were talking about the cover, we decided to go with something that looked like a heavy metal album on purpose.
Yeah. It has that feeling for sure.
And that's partly because I actually compose a lot of poetry to music. I'm a drummer, so it comes in mind. And I tend to listen to classical music, sort of avant-garde jazz, and black metal when I'm composing, because it's so rhythmically interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. It's not even necessarily that like those are the genres I really dig, but I need to listen to something that either I don't understand the lyrics to or it doesn't have them. Because I don't want that getting into my poetry by accident.
Yeah.
And it has a very complicated rhythm when I'm drafting, because when I do scanning, I want complicated scansion. So it helps.
Yeah.
That was really part of the aesthetic of the book.
Yeah. That's really interesting. There's sort of like as I was looking at it, I can see the heavy metal poster or, you know, album cover influence here. It also sort of looks like these sort of end times right-wing fundamentalist Christian books about, you know, sort of like a Hal Lindsey kind of inspired book.
Oh, yeah.
About the, you know, apocalypse and the rapture and all that kind of thing. Because you get the you get the mix of current events with, you know, political figures here. There's the Pope, or Pope Benedict, actually. It's not even the current Pope. And then, you know, there's some Hydra looking animal. And so it has this sort of Book of Revelation feeling to it as well. And I do know that I remember you mentioning or referencing the cave of Patmos at one point in one of the poems that I want to talk about. And so, I think that there's a really interesting, and apparently it's a really interesting image. You can see it on the link that I put in the show notes to the book itself. According to the inside cover, you can actually purchase a 60x40 centimeter poster version of it.
Yep.
How you go about doing that, I don't see.
Just go to look up Adrian Kenyon's in Google, and his website will come up, and he will totally send one of those to you from France.
Yeah. Oh,
I think it's like 15 pounds or something. It's not. It's not a lot of money. It's not cheap, but it's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
So you can have it on your wall.
Yeah.
I have it on my wall.
And it's quite interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else to say about that process or that image for you?
Oh, what I love about that image is you're not wrong to see the right wing political stuff in there. If you look very closely at the details, more and more of it will show up. Like, there's Bilderberger conspiracy references in the image.
I noticed that, yes.
There's references to, like, there's references to wildfires, which actually is the theme of the book. There's very specific, like, no logo brand stuff in the there's a ton of stuff going on in the image. And the more you look at it, the more you'll see. So I strongly encourage people to do so.
Yeah. In the trash pile that's at the bottom of the image, there's sort of like this landscape of garbage of, you know, the refuse of capitalism, I suppose. There's so many little details about the product. There's a very interesting take on product placement, I would say, in that image. So,
and this gets more meaningful if you see the entire series. There's three things in this. There's three or four things in this image, and the images build on each other, and they're kind of a satire on dispensationalist Protestantism and their right wing overlaps. Although, again, that is more relevant 10 years ago than now. I don't want people to think that I think dispensationalists are post or premillennialist Protestantism and dominionist are really a problem for us politically anymore, because Trump proves that that's all irrelevant now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is an interesting, and it's, you know, I've been thinking the last few weeks, maybe it was because we've been talking about Infinity War, but I am more and more interested in the apocalypse and not only religious versions of it, but there are sort of secular versions of the apocalypse that are, you know, prevalent in our culture right now as well, both liberal and conservative. And so I have no idea how to frame a show like that, but I feel like this is another clue that I need to be figuring out how to do that. I would like to do a show exploring that dynamic of our culture right now. If anybody listening has any ideas, feel free to shoot me some information about that. Let's get into the poetry here a little bit. What are some of the themes in this collection that you think are most important for us to understand? And if you can maybe tie them to some of the formal choices that you make, I think that would be great.
So the themes of this book are kind of complicated, to say the least. So there are three different religious voices that come up in the book. One is a composite Catholic voice that is loosely based off people in my own family that a narrator adopts. One is a sort of background of fundamentalist Southern Baptism, which was the dominant religion where I grew up. And one is more of my inclination, which is sort of vaguely Jewish, but really kind of generally skeptical of religious claims. And those three voices are intertwined. And there is a deliberate movement from mystical to secular over and over and over again. So you'll see, one of the most explicit and in some ways literally explicit is in the poem "Making Love to Televised War," where Saint Anthony the Great shows up from, you know, the Egyptian saint, and he's talking about, you know, people going, and it's the reference in his end of days prophecies and him going insane and being taunted by demons and going out into the desert and living alone as kind of a solitary anchorite, and that is conflated with someone who, in my mind, is a war vet, but is trying to not deal with that and is kind of having some meaningless sex, and has the news kind of interrupt that with trauma, and the three things get conflate, and you see that happen over and over and over again. There's also a lot of there's a lot of violence in this book, both explicit and implied, and that also has to do with a lot of that. I was very interested in what Christian readers would have to say about this book, because I do so much, like, I do think actually if you have a strong religious education, there are things about the book that would make more sense to you than if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it's not all about that. I mean, a lot of it's about Wittgenstein. A lot of it's about the inability of language to actually communicate very complicated things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is about dealing with the ambiguity of sexual liberation and how, for a lot of people, it is not nearly as liberatory as people think it is. And then a lot of people are not as emotionally mature as they've thought they were when they deal with their own indiscretions and how that pairs up. And the idea of sexuality being used as a poor substitute for either religiosity or compensation for trauma comes up over and over again as well.
Hmm. That seems to be a really salient political point in our current moment, right? I mean, that yeah. isn't just a passing observation. That seems to speak to a lot of the tension among and between the left and liberalism. And so I think that there's something.
Yeah. Although incels were not a thing when I wrote this.
I'd never heard that term until about 3 weeks ago. And then when I figured out what it was, I was kind of astonished and embarrassed for knowing. And so, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But that's been on my mind for a while because I am of the age to have been scared by AIDS and then for it to not be scary anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in college, I feel like that led to a lot of, and I actually think my part of the millennial generation was more sexually adventurous than the younger ones. And I think there's actually real sociological stats to bear that out. But there's a whole lot of stuff in the culture. This is obliquely referenced in the movie, and I've told this story before, but one of the poems references that we were watching a movie right after 9/11 happened. Yes. And it's a poem I think you wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So I'll read it in a minute. But the movie we were watching was Sod.
Oh, really? Okay. S-A-A-D.
That's a real life thing. And actually, I left that detail out of the poem because I didn't think people would believe me.
Okay.
But we were watching Sod because that was what we had on hand. And the Jeffrey Rush film from like 1999, I think. And that was what was in the air.
Huh.
I also think about David Cronenberg and J.G. Ballard, and a lot of that stuff comes up as well.
Yeah, you also mention an Argento film in one poem here, and so we can kind of get to the was that one? Aesthetic theory, I believe, right? And so yeah, I sort of get into that in a little bit. I also want you to talk a little bit about your formal choices. Most of these poems, I would say, are just simple, kind of a straight column of text. We have enjambment that sort of complicates the grammar of the sentences a little bit. But then
there's three or four sonnets that people didn't realize were formal.
Yeah, exactly.
Formally,
it's mostly kind of, it's not very experimental, let me just say that, okay? And then you have some that very clearly are. And so, for example, late night, like blended fruit is one, but actually the one I wanted to talk about was learning how to fall. And so, I mean, this is it almost looks like digital binary code or something like that. You've got lines that are broken up with large gaps. I don't see a picture created by this.
Is not concrete poetry.
Okay. And so, there seems to be you're disrupting the flow of this text purposefully, making kind of alternative groupings of words, vertically across the lines, not just horizontally. And so, you want to talk about maybe that decision and juxtapose that against most of the poems, which are kind of very traditionally formed.
So there's kind of an interesting story to that. I started off as a much more avant-garde poetry than a poet than I am now. And I still write kind of experimental poems, but I also came to a point where I thought that if you were going to do that, there better be a good reason for it. So I slowed down in it a bit. So the original draft of this book actually had way more of that in here.
Okay.
When I compose books now, I tend to try to alternate between like standard free verse, maybe short line, maybe long line, but standard free verse, formal poetry like sonnets and pantoons and ghazals. I actually use a lot of Chinese and Japanese form poetry too. Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, and just a little bit of your biography. I mean, you have lived all over the world, right? You lived in Korea and Egypt. And so you do have this very kind of broad cultural experience that shows up in your poetry then. Okay.
But when it comes to what informs my formal choices. So unless I'm writing a explicitly traditionally formal poem, and those poems on the explicitly traditionally formal, I actually tend to try to hide deliberately that it's a formal poem. I want people to have to read a poem twice before they realize it's a sonnet. Mm. unless I say in the title it's a sonnet. On the poems that you're talking about, so like Learning How to Fall, it's about disruption. Mm-hmm. Thematically, it's about disruption. It is about when your identity starts to break apart. And so what I did about that is I wanted it to be a stochastic voice. If you read it the way I wrote it, one, it'd be a stochastic voice. And two, you would struggle to create meaning out of its form. So you could read chunks of it together and get different things out of it sonically. And it's supposed to be read that way.
Oh, good. I did it right.
Yeah. So if you get a normal narrative, if you read it, normally left, right. But if you start picking out the sections, you'll get bursts that are sonically relevant to each other. And it's not the easiest thing to read out loud. I'm gonna lie. One of my issues with one of the reasons why I quit doing that so much is you're asked to do readings as a poet all the time. And when a poet can and is meant to be read multiple ways, it's very hard to perform.
Yeah.
So I operate off of a theory called analogous form. It's from the poet Charles Olson, and that is with the idea that to the best of your ability, even when you're writing free verse, you should take formal considerations based on what it is about. And while you should, I am hesitant to go like full, you know, Marvel concrete poetry, you know, like it's an apple, it looks like an apple. Yeah. But I do use a lot of like the disruption or the formatting is supposed to mirror something, and it's telling you something about how to read the poem. And Learning How It Falls, one where the disruption is on purpose because of thematic of identity. Another one in the book that is like this, like Night Night Burning the Food is kind of like that. But a big one is Composition and Motion.
Okay.
Where it is not just doing it sonically, it's also doing it narratively. If you read, there's five columns.
Yes.
And the poet, and like, if you read each column straight down as if each column was one poem, you'll get a narrative completely from each one. And then if you start adding them together, you'll get a different narrative. And then you realize that part of this is like, memories that are relevant to like memories in one line, and one of the columns is relevant to what is happening in another.
Yeah.
And they're building on each other until they completely conflate at the end. And also it's scored like music.
How so?
I based it off of musical scoring. I was basing it off of like, minimalist composition where stuff repeats. So the patterns repeat in a way. And if you like listen to John Adams or, Philip Glass, who I don't like so much anymore, but you'll notice that they'll do repetition patterns until towards the end they start overlapping and going into each other. That does that explicitly.
And when it's interesting that the the introductory quote to that is by Wittgenstein, right? To this poem. And it's also, I mean, you'd mentioned you'd kind of classify yourself as a neo-modernist, I think is the term you used. Mm-hmm. And this very much does remind me of a modernist kind of multivocal technique, like you'd see in like The Sound of the Fury with William Faulkner, right? And so the kind of isolation and yet blending of a bunch of voices. And so it's very interesting how I think that it's laudable that you're paying that much attention to the way that form contributes to quote unquote content and the meaning of the poem. And it isn't just sort of a random or arbitrary container, but it actually helps. It works as a system with the images and the speaker's voices and that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why I like poetry, I started out when I started writing creative writing, I was a kind of a high, like a magical realist, high modernist short story writer, believe it or not. And I published like two of those on the web, like in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then I realized that my writing style tended to be super dense. And it was more exhausting for the reader in prose form than it was in poetry. And I also started thinking of poetry as like a mixture of painting and music together more than as just a narrative device. So I tend to pull, you know, from imagist. I'm very much from the H.D. Ezra Pound school of poetics, but also from the idea that you hit the reader emotionally first, then you hit them intellectually, and then you hear them narratively. So, and it's very, that's the opposite of the way you tend to function in fiction, where your narrative comes first, even when it's an avant-garde thing. The messing with the narrative is what comes first. So I think of poetry as a form to free up the idea that yes, narrative is often there, dramatis personis is often there. It's not the first thing the reader has to be concerned with, so it's not the first thing I'm concerned with the writing. The very first thing tends to be what images can I get people to, you know, and what metaphors can I get people to read this more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to set up the form so that it will mirror some kind of experience I want them to mirror. If it's just straightforward, I tend to write it in like, you know, three or four line quatrain. I mean, quatrains or whatever. And then the last thing you consider is like what the narrative flow is. And then actually you do that for the entire collection as well. So this is meant to be read, you know, like you can pick up any poem in it, but it actually is meant to be read in the order that it's in.
And there are two sort of main sections that, almost like I'm going back to the heavy metal cover thing. This feels in a lot of ways like a record album. It's interesting that you're making this, comparison to music and that you're drawing on the resources of music, to think about this. 'Cause it really does, feel like you're reading a musical album, a collection, an LP, if you will.
Yeah, I actually think of a book in those terms. So it should have a movement. One movement should be clear. The next movement should be clear. There should be a clear progression. It is not a narrative progression. It's a thematic progression, but it needs to be there. And so I do think the idea of like a very well-written LP is a good model for how you write a book of poetry.
Yeah.
It's not a good model for how you would write a novel.
No.
So that's kind of how I come at it. And I think that may be part of why a lot of people who are normally scared by avant-garde poetry actually like my work.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at it on the page or you start like trying to figure out the references first, it's really intimidating. But if you just approach it like music first and you listen to it, and then like music, you listen to it again and you hear something else and you start hearing the sub notes and then you start feeling the like under themes and the undertones, and then you notice the rhythms, and then you notice all the references, and then you notice the references to other things.
Yeah.
But it unfolds over a long period of time, and that's what it's supposed to do.
You know what this reminds me of is a really one of the really great Kinks records that is kind of thematic, and yet the songs all stand together, and yet they're put together in these kind of operatic grand structures that these kind of connecting themes all work together. So I don't know if you're a Ray Davies fan, but so
I am.
Let me get to a couple of the things that I noticed, and then, you know, I'll maybe let you read if you want to pick a poem to read, if that's okay.
Well, I'll start off with one of the poems that you wanted to talk about for sure. So,
okay.
But yeah, but go ahead and then we'll
okay. do that. So one of the things, kind of motifs that I've noticed in reading this a couple of times now is there's sort of a theme of, binariness or duality, people being torn kind of in opposite directions at the same time. And I, first of all, wondering if that has something to do with your kind of Marxist Hegelian dialectical mind, or but the one poem that really it stands out, and it's one in which the religious references gets ramped up. It's called Feed Your Wolves. And it's written in kind of two, you know, movements, and they're each one's called Yetzer Tov, and the next one is Yetzer Ra, and those are sort of that's a rabbinical notion of the impulse towards the good and impulse towards evil, and we all sort of live with this kind of tension between us, and you've kind of separated this poem into those two tensions, and that kind of duality is really interesting to me. Do you want to talk a little bit about this poem?
Sure. This is actually one of the newer poems in the book. I think it was written around 2012. And it is a sort of narrative dealing with a kind of the Feed Your Wolves is a rabbinic folktale about, you know, which wolf, the Yetzer Tov or the Yetzer Ra, do you feed? Which one's out in the end? And if you know anything about Jewish thought as opposed to Christian thought, and actually that opposition is played within this poem as well.
Exactly, yeah, because it begins with this kind of old Southern Protestant image of your grandfather. If I can, the aged worn hymnal near my bed was given to me by my grandfather. So you start with this kind of very conservative American Christianity, and then you pull it apart and see this Judaic roots.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a whole lot of autobiographical stuff in this, so I'll read the poem and then we can talk about the layers of this, because this is a poem that is explicitly autobiographical. Feed Your Wolves, 1, Yetzer Tov. The age-worn hymnal near my bed was given to me by my grandfather. The split leather and pages yellowed like coffee-stained teeth to guide me in singing praise like a Methodist I have never been. Once, my grandfather told me that in every man two wolves lie, one black with greed and anger, the other white with bravery, both willing to bloody their muzzle, but nipping at each other's throat at the heart of every man. I asked him which one would win, and he told me the one you feed. But now my grandfather's dust is mixed with Georgia clay. I know that feeding is only so easy, to strip of meat to one, the other snaps to scraps, growling, both growling in sinew and jaw, feasting on yourself as you lay supine. Yetzer Ra, 2. My mother's lupus gnaws on her face from within, and I watch my hand shake as she lifts her tea to her lips. Parched as they are with skin leathered with years, my partner's hands quake when her heart speeds up. I would rip open the sky to settle her nerves, smooth the neurons, unknot the muscle, the heart. An ex-lover and I talk between grief and grievance, not hinting that the almost daughter we treat as a ghost seems will despite stillbirth. She could not speak of it as a child, but neither could she not. Instead, leaving an offering to Jizo Buddha for safe passage between the life that could have been and might be. Pain between prosody and prosaic. I feed the wolves, needing both sets of teeth for the task of loving, as if one could choose between the love one wants and the love one has. No matter how the waste wilts One needs both jaws sharp. Between the mouths, I cannot bring myself to toss the hymnal into the fire, wash it curl into ash, then nothing, nor sing the shape notes. So a little bit about me. I think your listeners may have kind of parsed this out from hints I've given, and when we talk about movies in particular, it sometimes comes up. I am, from my father's side, nominally Jewish. But, and this is a big but, my father's parents converted to Methodism to fit in, basically. My father unconverted, then reconverted to Christianity. It's a very complicated thing, actually, but I have a very strained relationship with both the Methodist and Baptist church because I grew up around them, but I was not baptized. So there's a lot going on in this formally too, and so that biographical note might help a little bit. The theological thing here is, from the Jewish perspective, the Yeser Ra is not good, but you absolutely have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why God gave you a dark side is sometimes you need that dark side. Because you have to protect someone, you have to do something. Sometimes those things actually require it's built into the Jewish metaphysical system. Sometimes evil is required to maintain the good.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a concept that I think Christians really can have.
Yeah, that's very challenging to Christianity, right? But I see it in other places too, like the golem, the folktale of the golem, right?
Right, yeah. It's all in rabbinic stuff, actually. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right. In the golem, and there's golem imagery. There's some formal stuff you may not have noticed. The Yeser Tov is written in three-line stanzas. Why do you think that is? It's about Christian
Trinitarian imagery.
Yeah, it's about Christians. Deliberately, yeah. Trinitarian imagery. And the Yeser Ra is in four-line stanzas, which is balanced.
I did not notice this. This is amazing. okay, keep going. This is awesome.
Yeah.
This is why you should buy this book, everybody. You'll get lots of nuggets like this.
Both end in couplets, because mm-hmm. couplets are seem complete. But they're actually like kind of metrically aren't. The couplets also scan longer than the rest of the, if you actually count, like, if you were to scan this poem, even though it doesn't seem formal, it actually is in a semi-formal meter, and the couplets at the end off don't scan like the rest of the lines. So that's all on purpose. The stuff about Jizo Buddha, another thing about me is my father's religious background is kind of complicated in that, we have this Hebraic thing going on, but we also have the fact he's kind of a Joel Osteen Protestant now. I kind of make fun of him for it. But when I was a kid, he flirted with Buddhism a lot, and I was raised around that. And I lived in Korea for a long time, and there's a lot of traditions of mourning, and there's a particular tradition in Japanese Buddhism about mourning stillborn and aborted children that is interesting, because abortion is not treated as an evil in the clear way that it is in Christianity, but it is treated as a real tragedy that is best to avoid it. And while this is not about an abortion, it is about a stillbirth. They have a way, the same grieving process where you actually go and pray to Jizo Buddha, who is a Buddha of compassion, actually. It's a manifestation of another Buddha, blah, blah, blah. It's really complicated. I don't necessarily want to get into all that.
Yeah.
But you will dress a baby form. Like, it looks like a little chibi Buddha, and you dress it up for the child that didn't make it. And that's a grieving process for mothers who lose their children in birth, but also for people who have abortions. And the kind of ambivalence about that being unable to to treat a stillbirth as like a cleanly as like losing a person, but it is treated as something to be grieved and as a very real being. And that's in the background. The way, you know, a refusal to accept what Christians will call natural evil, which to me, natural evil theologically is way more hard to deal with than if you believe in free will, then which as someone with a Jewish background and a scientific background, I kind of actually don't. But but if you believe in free will, you can easily explain non-natural evil, like human evil, but natural evil is not anyone's choice. Mm. And so that to me, if you don't deal with that theologically, you're not being mature. And so that tension, then the tension of natural evil, one of the reasons that I very much enjoy dialogues I have with religious people and think it's super important to have, and it shows up in my poetry over and over again.
Yeah.
But natural evil is part of why I don't think I could ever be a Christian.
Okay.
Because I just cannot conceive of an all-loving God. Like, it's just not – I don't see it. And one of the things about being in a Jewish tradition, that's not demanded of me.
Yeah.
So, like
– this is interesting. And I don't know if you followed a couple of weeks ago, Andy Stanley made a little stir in evangelical circles for saying that Christians need to, I think he said, unhitch themselves or unhinge themselves from the Old Testament. And he's trying to get rid of this dualistic God, seemingly dualistic God, who is mischievous as well as benevolent. And so, I mean, he caused quite a stir for reasons that you seem to support on some level, right? I mean,
but I would support from the opposite point of view. I would call him a coward.
He's making the same distinction that you are, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the Christian dealing with what you guys would call the Father, with the Hebrew God is interesting. I mean, I don't think the Christian answer is dishonest, but I do think the idea that that justice is loving, that being is loving, that idea is debated in Judaism, to be frank. Like, it's not a foreign idea to Judaism either, but for the most part, if you read the Talmud or you read your Midrash, God is seen as loving, but God is more than that. And there's things from this kind of Jewish perspective, just by passing God off as all loving is actually to diminish God.
Okay.
Because God is the source of everything.
Yeah. And so is this a question of theodicy for you then? Like why God allows bad things to happen? Like what explains evil in the world? Is this sort of,
I mean, to me, when I meet atheists, you know, and I would say I'm secular. I would not necessarily call myself an atheist, not just because as a cop out. I don't even know exactly what we're rejecting most of the time. I think most atheist atheologies are really, 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 really vapid.
Okay.
They
often mirror the worst kind of fundamentalist believers.
When I meet atheists, if the atheist I tend to respect tends to have to deal, has to deal with the craze of religion on their terms.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk about like rejecting it for scientific reasons, whatever, fine, but that's not entirely what religion is about. If you reject, and Chris Hedges gets in this, like why he respects Nietzsche more than Richard Dawkins, because Nietzsche's problems are more theodicy.
Yeah.
They're not biblical literalism versus science or whatever. Right. That's not what's at stake.
Right. And that's a fairly recent way for even Christians to think of the Bible. Right. And so they're having a conversation that really very few people have ever cared about. So,
yeah. And so like, that's not what interests me about that debate either.
Yeah.
What interests me about that debate is what it applies for how you deal with morality, how you deal with your relationship to other people, what you need to do. And the duality there is the refusal to say like, oh, like, you know, when I talk about the end where I refuse to toss a hymnal into the fire.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm not willing to reject my grandfather, but I'm also not taking his advice.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think his advice is sound.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is one of the, like I said, this is one of the few poems where most things in it are autobiographical. So this is a really felt thing for me.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you clued into this poem, because this poem I think is one of the key things. It comes in the last third of the book, and it's a transition point.
Yeah.
Poem on purpose. So.
Yeah, it clearly, I mean, marked a point of some sort of development in the book to me. And just going back to your point about I honestly didn't even catch the shift in from three lines to four. But that is just wonderful. I just, the formalist in me just, it's just all tickly about that. But at one point near the end of that first section of the poem, you have that moment where the grandfather, when you ask which one would win, and he told me the one you feed. In most kind of, if this were a Christian poem, the poem would end there. There's like a moral to the story. There is clear moral advice to be given from grandfather to grandchild, and go and do likewise my son, right? And that's not even the middle of this poem, right? That's sort of like the jumping off point from this poem. And that's where I do see, it's midrashic, right? You have this kind of elaboration then upon something that is never really finished, right? These ideas are never really kind of finished. They're only kind of spin out into new ideas and new questions.
So we could talk, you know, you and I have spent a lot of our time talking about, when you're not having me talk about leftist politics, talking about, you know, Christian art. And yeah. I have this weird love of Christian artists,
yeah.
But I hate didactic Christian artist.
Well, yeah. For the same reason you probably hate didactic political art.
Yeah, right? I just said for similar reasons, except that I think the didactic Christian artists are often not even doing a service to their theology, because like I actually do think Christian thought is very, very rich, even if I disagree with it or think it's wrong. And that when you cut it short in like a simple didactic point like that, it often undersells what's going on. So like my favorite Christian poets, and a lot of the poets I like are like, I like Mark Jarman. Mark Jarman does not end on didactic points. He's constantly complicating the religious vision he presents. You see that in the Unholy Sonnets that he wrote. I love Gerard Manley Hopkins, who portrays Jesus as an eagle or a raptor. You know, there's a hard edge to Jesus that complicates the love that Gerard Manley Hopkins feels for him. And it's something underexplored in even conservative Christian thought.
Yeah.
You look at someone like Tarkovsky, who we've already talked about.
I was just going to, you know, if you're just listening and you're unaware of this, six months ago or so, go back into our back catalog. There's a really great conversation. At least I enjoyed it so much with you about Andrei Rublev.
I forgot to mention that story. The original, the very original cover for this was an Andrei Rublev.
See, that would have been perfect.
Icon.
That also would have worked as well. We've had conversations about this, and that is that's a form of Christian art. I mean, Tarkovsky is sort of an Eastern Orthodox Christian, right? And so,
but it's against the evangelical.
Oh, absolutely.
In Christian art, like,
and that's why it's so much better. This is not pure flicks. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's my thing about Christian art. Most, like, say, Christian music or Christian rock. It's not Christian at all. It's secular, poorly done, with Jesus thrown in as a reference.
Sure.
It is not – it doesn't come out of a Christian culture. It doesn't have Christian iconography. It is like a bait-and-switch attempt with pop culture.
Yeah.
And like, I spent a lot of this book making fun of that, frankly. Yeah. So, like, when you mention Hal Lindsey, I kind of think Hal Lindsey's like that. And I find that if I was a Christian, unless again I'm not, I would find it heretical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wouldn't just be, like, tacky. It would be heresy.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, like, you know, as a non-Christian, but I'm willing to make that call, I find a lot of attempts to deal with, say, like, Hal Lindsey stuff. I do think that's heretical. I think it a lot of times it makes Jesus your political figure. It makes God just the image of you and your immediate, you know, political and social concerns, which God must think like I do. And for me, and maybe this is a little bit of the Jewishness throwing through, a God worshiping is like me, maybe incarnated like me in some way, in some Christian sense, but is not me.
Mm-hmm.
It's fundamentally other, fundamentally yes. different, and fundamentally more.
Yeah.
And I'm not interested in the, like, personal relationship with Jesus.
1 hour and 10 minutes. Varn says S. All right. Yet another beef. My notes are filling up here. That's okay though. Like I said, so the points you're making, I totally agree with, actually. As you know, I mean, we agree on 90% of everything we end up talking about from completely different angles, obviously. But and I totally agree with your assessment of didactic Christian art and this kind of politicization. And it isn't just conservative Christians that do this. I think you have this kind of progressive Christianity right now.
Peter Rollins.
Well, I can't even speak to that person. I haven't read him, and so I don't.
I'm supposed to do a panel with him actually in October, so I'm just picking on him to start it off.
You told me about that actually, and I can't wait to listen to that. I don't want to lump him into what I'm about to say since I haven't read him, but there's this kind of Twitter progressive Christian who basically wants to make the Democratic Party's running platform what Christianity is. And it's sort of this attempt to craft Christianity into this kind of political vision. And it's not exclusive to a conservative approach to Christianity, right? This happens as well. And the
to make quote this unquote, relevant to your readers, side. To me, that's idolatry.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think it totally is, right? Yeah. I think that that's exactly how I would describe it as well too, right? I mean, you're taking something that is, eternal, and you're sticking in a form upon it and worshiping the form.
Right? And a very historically, I mean, you're going to hear some Marxist language come out of here, but like a very historically situated, very, very limited. Because I mean, even as a social moment, it's a very specific social moment for a specific time. That's not even secularly transcendent.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, that's the ultimate God thinks like me horse poop.
Thank you. Good boy. I feel like the evangelical grandfather here. Absolutely. And I totally agree with you there. And it's one thing I appreciate about your poetry is in the way that it is critical of Christianity, it's not critical of Christianity. It's critical of Christendom and a form of Christianity and a form of kind of Christian thought that has kind of calcified into particular cultural expressions. And I think that that's what you point out very beautifully in this great poem, Feed Your Wolves.
Yeah. So you would like to talk about another specific poem?
Yeah, let's, I don't want to be here all night. So let's, why don't you pick something to talk about and we'll just kind of close it from there. I wanted to talk about the duality. And just incidentally on that point, going back to Feed Your Wolves again, what page? I lost my page, 47. Going back to Feed Your Wolves, the kind of the dualistic theme is not only in the metaphor of having the two wolves, right? It's not only in the form of there being two kind of movements, but it comes up over and over. Especially towards the end of the poem, we have all of these images, for the life that could have been and might be. You have two sort of possibilities there. Pain between prosody and prosaic. You have sort of two possibilities there. I feed the wolves needing both sets of teeth. There's another one there. As if one could choose between the love one wants and the love one has. So, I mean, this, you populate this poem with images, again, of this kind of conflict, this sort of dualistic inner conflict that I want to relate. I keep wanting to relate back to this kind of dialectic of history. It's something that drives something forward, right? Past the moment of a settled, didactic, easy moral answer. There's this sort of dualism that drives it on past that into something more kind of eternal and much more kind of useful for the imagination.
Well, part of the point between those dualities is also that one may negate the other, but neither will get you out of the situation that you're in. And there is a sort of Hegelian point to that, in that you have to go through both to really be able to deal with either thing. And what you're going to come out with isn't going to look like, it's going to be a third thing. It's not going to be either.
Yeah. Yeah. The synthesis, right?
Well, the synthesis, I've always been interested in that translation of off people because I don't actually think it's correct, but, well,
And I'm very, you know, I'm a total lay person when it comes to this.
But hyper Marxoid thought, and I don't write what hyper Marxoid thought in mind actually, but I guess that there is these dualities come up. The third thing is a negation of negation of negation, which is really complicated. But when two things collide, if you think about it in terms of systems or physics, what emerges from that, even if one side wins, it is not the same thing that went into the conflict.
Yeah, it's a chemical reaction almost, yeah. Right? Yeah.
So like when you go through that, if you try to pick to either side, you're denying something about yourself and something about the way you have to deal as a person. Now, I mean, I think you can go a little bit nutso with this, and some Marxists do. And I also, I think this way, like, I think before I even knew who Hegel was, I kind of thought this way. This is just sort of the way I process life. Mm-hmm. But because I find dualistic heresies and to be terrifying. Like, Manichaeism is, like, scary to me. So
And that's the term that people were using for Andy Stanley here. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, he sounds like a Marcionite, really. Mm. You want to get your heresies right.
I think that's the term. I think that was the one. You're right. I misremembered. You're right. So.
But anyway, I know my Christian heresy.
You know it better than I do. I probably practice it better than you do, but yeah, you definitely know the terms.
You're probably a Monosophite or something.
I don't even want to know.
I'm gonna actually just read both poems real fast and we can talk about them together.
Okay.
I'm gonna read what is the third poem in the collection, which kind of opens it up, and the second to last poem, which kind of closes it out.
Okay.
Because they're thematically juxtaposed on purpose.
Okay.
All right. Apocalyptics. Too many lattes for memories to flow easily, but not whiskey to take it straight. Remembering sweat from the swelter as the Twin Towers fell. My girlfriend in Johnstown, but the phone's nothing but distant static. After everyone stopped crying, two young women kissed on the couch as we watched a movie to avoid the repeat of the news. I once read the way the cells can mutate, growing over fecund and exploding. No Jasper John's canvas blank enough, stark enough for the memory of a woman stripped to bra and panties, crying at a party. The turn of that last millennium, the weight of zeros hitting her core as she partially strip-teased away to the future in a champagne haze. One wants to see too much. I have been here to the remains of the cave on Patmos, nothing but the historical markers and rocks. My father, my king, my fear of sex addiction, like a cicada's carapace. I woke with a love of with a lover between me and another man that New Year's Eve. When I return to the places where the night stays dark, I see myself emerging with a soft exoskeleton, sore from all the changes I am. Mm. And then I'm going to end that off with grace. Grace. We We start work of philosophy composed entirely of jokes. The philosopher giggles to himself as he shrinks back into his naive tweed. We pretend we get it. You are here, a dot on the map. In the cartographies of the future, you are still a dot. And you will think of her as a train goes by, speeding towards the edge of the map. To make a woman laugh, I would undo the knot at the base of the stomach, lead the eyes to heavily lift, cause a smile to palpitate into small, subtle breaths. You stand at the exit. Flirting is funny, but wonder at the punchline. I would photograph you smiling under the red light, an evacuation sign. The map didn't mention it. Some gag, you think. You hold your hand out to mind, ricocheting off the edges of the legend. To know a woman, trust me. Open up the ribcage, splaying with delicate scalpel, causing more dots smeared under topography. My smile lingers a bit too long. In the cavity of my chest, you pack the sinew thick with mud. Loosely form a heart to grow lilacs and small sweet berries. With dirty hands, you giggle.
And you purposefully place these as kind of bookends almost. Not literally bookends, but they sort of function that way.
There are two literal bookends to the book, but yeah.
And so explain, what do they have to do with one another?
Well, apocalyptics is obviously apocalyptics, but what's interesting about the apocalyptics is, did you catch all the apocalypse? They're all secular apocalypses, but did you catch them all?
I doubt it, but, they're not all secular. You have John of Patmos in here, right?
Yes. I really did go to that island, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, is that right? Oh, that's great. Yeah.
When I lived in Egypt, I got all over the Mediterranean when in my spare time.
The Twin Towers, obviously that's kind of an end of an era in America, right?
Y2K.
Zeros. Oh, the dancing, the Y2K scare. I had forgotten all about the Y2K thing.
Yeah, Y2K is in there. There is the reference of the millennialist religious apocalypse everyone thought was going to happen in 2000.
Yeah.
And most of that party is real party. I really remember people acting that way.
Yeah.
Where there's this weird mixture of religious fervor and like depression and sex.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of experimenting with sexuality in this poem. And some of it I didn't even put in the poem. Like I told you, the movie that we're watching on the night of 9/11 is Sod.
Yeah.
That's not in the poem, but it's a very real fact. There's, you know, two co-eds kissing, experimenting with homosexuality. There's all that going on. This is not a critique of it, but it's also noting that it's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not unraveling anything
for an apocalypse that doesn't happen, right? I mean,
all the apocalypses are not actually apocalypses. That's part of the point.
Yeah.
Like, and you go to, you know, when I go to Patmos, I was just stuck about how just stark and bunch of rocks it was.
Yeah.
There was not a whole lot there.
Yeah. And that was one question I had about this poem. You have this kind of, particularly that moment where you talk about the cave on Patmos. This is supposedly the place where John has this the vision that becomes the Book of Revelation, right? The resolution to that visit is nothing but historical markers and rocks. It's almost like there's a denial of any kind of end of history. There's a denial of anything beyond material reality. And so this I took to be your secularism, it kind of throwing cold water on religious fervor.
Yeah, it's part of it. And I think, you know, the other reason that I've never been able to be a Christian, and I was talking to a pastor when I was 17 years old, and I said, you know, when I read the Gospels, it was clear to me that he said things were going to end pretty quickly.
Uh-huh.
And unless you're going to explain to me how they did end, I guess maybe you meant the temple, you got some splaining to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the question is, was this sort of an interpretive mistake on the Christians' part, or is that a flaw in Christianity, right? That's sort of...
Well, like, I mean, my adult self would say, like, it actually depends on which gospel you read, frankly.
Yeah.
But because the Jesus is in each gospel's to me, one of the most fascinating things that I ever did was I sat down and when I read the gospels, when I think I was about 22 years old, I reread them. And I read them deliberately stripping any harmonization.
Okay. So, okay.
I read them so generously as like, this is this Jesus.
Okay.
And this is this Jesus. And this is this Jesus. And this is this Jesus. And one of the things that amazed me is the synoptics. I always thought maybe the synoptics were all together and John was different. No, they're all radically kind of different.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my like beef about Christianity gets a lot less beefy when you actually have a kind of realistic understanding of the way the texts work, I think.
Yeah.
But from a person who was raised around Catholics on one end and biblical literalists on the other, both Jewish and Christian, that stuff is hard to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
But the secular pouring on some religion there is not just pouring it on religion, because one of the things that fascinates me is, and the reason why I use secular apocalypses over and over again, is that stuff it's not just part of the Christian mind.
Yeah.
It's deeply rooted in the American mind in ways that I think are more problematic for non-Christians than Christians are people who are just nominally Christian but aren't really active believers in any way.
Okay.
I'm also just as harshly critiquing that.
Yeah.
Because I think that leads to a lot of moral confusion and abnegation of responsibility and abnegation of what human relationships are.
Yeah.
You
see all that.
It's kind of a pop out.
And you see all that apocalyptic, all those predictions every electric cycle. Like if when Mitt Romney becomes president, you know, every woman is going to have like a steel box chained to their pelvic regions, right? You know, and so that's barely an exaggeration of some of the rhetoric, that this apocalyptic sort of rhetoric. That's coming from a completely secular perspective,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, so from my perspective, I just think all that's silly. I mean, I think it's particularly silly. Left ring, white ring, religious, non-religious. And the religious to me seems more justifiable. So I am in some ways mocking that, although the experience of that is so real. And I'm not giving myself an out because – that felt apocalyptic even to me at the time. One of the things I mentioned, and this is a true fact from my life, my girlfriend at the time was going to school in Erie, Pennsylvania, but she's from Johnstown, and she was back home when 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
Or I thought she was. And so when the plane went down in Johnstown, I freaked out.
Oh.
Yeah,
it was Somerset, not far from Johnstown. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, where the plane
It's in Somerset
down.
County, which is right by Johnstown. You just going to go over there. I mean, I've been to that site before they put the official, but even before they put the official memorial up there.
Yeah.
That experience of trauma is misinterpreted as an end of the world.
Yeah. Okay. Say more about that. Because one question I have for you, maybe this will transition into you talking about the last poem, that Grace. Most of us just naturally think of the term apocalypse as the end of the world. That's what the term means, right? But actually,
it's unveiling
or uncovering, right? And so, does that play into your use of the term?
Definitely.
Okay.
So what you are uncovering throughout that, and that's the end. That's the end stanza. I'll read the last five lines so that you get it again. When I return to the places where night stays dark.
Okay.
Play on light on purpose.
Yeah.
I see myself emerging with a soft exoskeleton, sore from all the changes I am.
Okay.
You have been changed by this experience.
Okay.
But you are taking that change as an ending.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely not. It is actually the beginning. You are becoming an adult.
Yeah.
That's what that is about. That's why I start the book with the apocalypse poem.
Yeah.
And it's right. I will say this. It's also right after another poem. It's another poem called Another Ars Poetica. And then right before that is a poem called Violence, Catechesis, and Catechism, which is you know, about the same thing, which is about the way trauma is interpreted and often seen as an ending. It's seen as a stop, as a place where you cannot grow. Even the way we talk about it secularly, the way we treat it therapeutically. But if you freeze trauma in time, and you know, I say this as a person. Actually, I have complex PTSD, so like I know. If you freeze trauma in time, it is way more damaging than if you process it. Mm-hmm. And I think I interpret a lot of the religious stuff in here as processing what amounts to not just your personal trauma, but cultural trauma, and in a way, the trauma of history itself.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on. And that's why it starts off there. And then you end not where most Christians would begin, end in grace.
Yeah.
And then what I'm saying grace is, which is, you know, you're right, is not a Christian growth at all. And that poem is also pretty complicated, but you'll notice the tone of the poem is almost 180 degrees different than the apocalypse one.
Yeah.
But the thematic concerns actually overlap. So grace, you know, you start off with the idea of a philosophy composed of jokes. Actually, that was something Wittgenstein
and there's
two philosophers that show up over and over again.
Yeah.
And they're actually kind of in dialogue with each other, which is Giacomo Leopardi, who is like this weird aphorist and poet who's super pessimistic, didn't have any hope for the future. And then Wittgenstein, who is this sort of quasi-Marxist secular mystic who, you know, I mean, like, Wittgenstein to me is like, even though he's one of the foundations of analytic philosophy, he's a mystic.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of a philosophical mystic. So there's a dialogue between them going on in this book. And this is another reference to Wittgenstein. But my point in this is, and it's highly metaphorical and kind of surreal in ways that the other poem isn't, but is that what grace is being able in this book anyway, is being able to have and maintain adult relationships, both between a man and a woman, between a man and a man, between a woman and a woman, but also as a society.
Yeah.
As a kind of vision for what human flourishing is.
Yeah.
And that's all. And there is, it's not all, and it's deliberately not. I don't end it in like this happy image. The image that you end is building a person up, but you're building them up by ripping out their heart and rebuilding it.
Yeah.
From the ground, literally.
Yeah.
Like God did.
Yeah. Well, and I noticed that it's a woman and who to know a woman, trust me, opens up the rib cage. And it's sort of a Adam and Eve sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
But everything's inverted.
Inverted. Yeah. It's an inverted Adam and Eve. Yeah. So that's very interesting, Derek. And I think I wasn't able to put those together in my head, but now that you've sort of explained it, I guess if I had read this 100 times or something, it probably would have come to me. But that actually makes a lot of sense as to how this is a resolution to the kind of inverted Christian structure that you've put on this. You begin with apocalypse and kind of take it as almost a Kafkian metamorphosis, right? It's something that's just becoming changed, right? It's an uncovering and unveiling, and that simple, like going back to the poem about your grandfather, the wolves, what was that one called? Feed Your Wolves. The idea that the poem doesn't end where a Christian would end it. That's kind of the beginning. The whole book works like that, kind of, right? And the truth, is uncovered by kind of deliberation and philosophizing, I guess, if you will, upon that kind of inherited, settled truth.
Yeah, and I think that one of the epigrams that's good to think of is pulled from Wittgenstein too, but it is the you get tragedy when a tree instead of bending breaks.
Yeah.
The inflexible are punished in this book.
Yeah.
They are punished severely. And that's not just out of statism. I mean, to me, like, one of the things about the dualities and is the ability to learn how to grow, because if you do not grow and you become overly rigid from violence, from trauma, I mean, we haven't talked about this element. I mean, war is all in the background of this book. Because, yeah. I mean, at the time that I was writing it, particularly in 2005 to 2006, I was working, I was moonlighting a lot of the times at, I mean, one, I actually worked in a prison for some of the time. And then for another, I was moonlighting, you know, as an adjunct professor at a military college. And I dealt with a lot of my students who were about my age, actually. I mean, we were about the same age at the time, because I was doing this when I was 24, 25, 26. They were broken by the Iraq War.
Yeah.
You know, they came back, but they weren't functional people.
Yeah.
And they couldn't maintain relationships. They, you know, I'm not going to say every one of them, I mean, probably more could than couldn't, but it was a long process of healing and dealing with it. And it wasn't something they had a lot of resources for.
Yeah.
And that's in the back of my mind when I wrote this. Yeah, I mean, you know, the book itself it took 10 years to write. So,
yeah. Well, and how many revisions, right? I mean, talk about change, right?
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, this was originally, I think, like I said, this is 100 pages of poetry, right? But like, I think only 30% was in the first draft of the book. So, yeah.
So I don't know how many of our listeners have my particular background, but, you know, I grew up in this kind of low Protestant church, evangelical church tradition. And my memory, I think I've said this before on previous podcasts, of church, my memory of church is very kind of dark. It's always nighttime and somebody's reading some current events as signs that, you know, the rapture is about to happen. There's a book that's published when I'm in high school called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. It's a little booklet. Yeah.
You are also of the age to have gone to church during the Satanic Panic scare.
Oh, absolutely. Stuff, right.
It's just ending when I was of age to remember them.
Yeah. And so, and by the way, I want to do a show about that little pamphlet. I found a PDF of it. If someone wants to be on the show to talk about that pamphlet, I will send you this PDF of this thing. And I definitely want to, explore this idea of apocalypse in more generally, but so my memory of that is sort of living with this notion that it's all going to end any day now. And literally there was like 2 days in September, I think, when the rapture was going to be in 1988, right? And this happens still to this day in some religious traditions. So that never happened, right? The world didn't end. It just continued. And so one of the struggles of my own life, and I assume lots of Christians who grew up in my era have struggled with this. You grow up expecting the end to happen. And what happens instead is a revealing, right? Something, a change is revealed. And so I really think that, particularly after talking with you about this, that this book of poetry is of interest to Christians, even though it sort of challenges. I mean, you're not a Christian, and you don't necessarily advocate any kind of Orthodox Christian belief.
Although, if I was a Christian, I would be an Orthodox Christian. So yeah. By that I mean big O.
Yes, when I say Orthodox, I say little. I mean little O, typically. But you're right. And by the way, I have a colleague here who's in a Byzantine Catholic, and he's agreed to come on the show in the next couple of weeks and talk about Eastern Catholicism. I think that should be kind of interesting.
That's part of my family heritage.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you so know. Look for that one. Back to the book. And so as a way for a Christian reader, particularly someone of my generation, who sort of grew up expecting apocalypse and it not happening. How do you move forward when the end you were promised doesn't happen, right? I was trying to be really good that week in September so I would make it to heaven and in the rapture, right? And it didn't happen. And I had to figure out how to live after that. And
as an outsider, has that died down? I feel like, I feel like the advent of the religious left being sort of a thing, although between you and I sort of find them obnoxious too.
Yes. I don't want to like
alienate your listeners who are upon it, but
I mean it's the old Groucho Marx finding a club that would have me as a member sort of thing, right? Like I have a really hard time grabbing a union card for any particular codified movement, because my tendency is to move to the edges of whatever I'm a part of and apply this kind of internal critique to it. And so I'm not one to ask about who's right and who's wrong in these, because if there are groups that I am sort of really a part of, I'm not really a part of. And that's just been the story of my life. But I do think that this kind of metaphysical apocalypse has moved way to the margins of Christianity. I think that you have to go to kind of, it's nowhere near as prevalent as it was when I was a kid, and not entirely for, and that's not been entirely a good thing. I think you get a lot of this kind of hand holding, you know, just be Jesus's friend theology, and it doesn't get to any kind of dark places. And I think that could have its own kind of damaging effects. These dark places that kind of theology took me to weren't all bad. I just all I want to say.
Yeah. I send my father, my biological father notes saying, kill the Joel Osteen in his head because I'm a jerk. But,
so yeah,
but you know, he's just like, you know, God doesn't want you to be comfortable if God exists.
Yeah, that's kind of this is like, who am I that God wants me to be happy, right? I mean, this is like, I don't understand this way of thinking. And so maybe that's a flaw on my part. But I am happy to talk to you, Derek, as always. That's a ham-fisted transition towards the end here. But I do want to thank you. I'm glad to have picked up this book. I really do want to encourage everyone who's listening to go to, if you go to our Facebook page, or if you go to sectarianreviewpodcast.com, I will put a link to the show notes. In the show notes, I will put a link to this book on the website, and you can find it on Amazon, and I suppose you can get it directly from the publisher as well. And it's really worth taking some time to read. And like I said, it's got the feel of avant-garde poetry, but it's much more accessible than that. And it's got a special interest to kind of disaffected Christian readers such as myself. I think that you'll find a lot to really be to chew on, and a lot of thought-provoking material here. Derek, do you have any kind of final words or advice for the reader?
If you pick this up, be patient with it, read it more than once. Don't try to figure out at first what I'm trying to tell you. Just let it wash over you. Yes, it's super complicated. Yes, there's multiple layers to it, but you don't have to get it all. Don't be intimidated by that. Lastly, it helps if you've been to the South. Mm-hmm. Now, I make references to all kinds of things. I mean, there's references to Japan. There's references to Greece. I have spent the last, I have spent the last 8 years outside of the United States, and I've been on 5 out of 7 continents. Mm. Been a lot.
Mm. Gotta get you in Antarctica. Job.
It's really better when you get other people to pay for it too. Just saying. It's one of the advantages to being a teacher, yes. Weirdly. But that aside, like, there, I do think I'm a Southerner, even though I live in Utah now, and I write a lot about the West too. But particularly this book, there's a lot of Georgia in it.
And
lot of the 80s and 90s in it. And the aughts. And while Trump's on the cover, it's not really about that, although it kind of is, I guess, by analogy, but it's not about that directly. And be nice, support poetry. I don't bite unless you ask me to or you pay me to.
And do you have any you have some live readings lined up?
I'll be reading at Louisiana Books Festival, the 20th anniversary of Unlikely Pest, also in Louisiana. I'll be reading in Atlanta on July 1st at a coffee shop in Marietta, and I'll be reading in Central Georgia. I'll also be appearing at some colleges in Utah and some colleges in Georgia, which I, if you follow my, there's two pages you can follow me. You don't have to follow me privately on Facebook, and I probably won't even friend you anyway, but, unless you tell me why, because I get harassed because lefties are mean.
Our episode about exiting the vampire castle a few weeks ago, which, by the way, has been by far my most popular episode ever of this show.
Because the lefties are now listening to a Christian podcast. You should have used this as a chance to evangelize. So
where can they find your stuff? I'm sorry.
So, like, most of them have never been to church. Yeah, in their lives, they probably never even smelt a church. So anyway, so what was I talking about?
Where we can find you?
If you find me, if you look up Apocalyptics by C. Derek Varn on Facebook, you'll find the page for my book, and I announce readings there. If you look up Systematic Commentary, which is my everywhere page, so if you friend that, because that also has my political stuff on it and a podcast I appear on, like this one, mm-hmm. It'll be listed there. You can find stuff if you follow Unlikely Press or Unlikely Stories Mach 5. You can find information because that's the publisher's page. Or if you follow Zero Books, which is my other employer other than my day job. It's my second day job, I guess. I don't know how that works. My night job. I don't know. You can find stuff about me there as well. And if you friend me on Facebook, it's C. Derek Varn, and you tell me that you want to talk poetry, I'll friend you back. But be warned, dear listener, you are entering a viper's nest.
And your feed will be forever the better for it. I enjoy following you on Facebook. You're one of the main reasons
I today I hit a post on unpopular opinions that I asked people to do that's now what is it? 1.7K comments. I'm even like, I can't read this.
You can lose an entire day in Derek's Facebook page easily. So, yeah. And I'll put links to all these things in the show notes again. SectarianReviewPodcast.com. You'll find the show notes. I really would like you to like our Facebook page, too, if you're still here, and take part of the conversation there. We get a really interesting mix of people with, I think, productive opinions and continuing these conversations. I'm very much enjoying that. So go ahead.
For fans, what? Check out the Christian Humanists. Even if you're not a Christian, they're interesting. They talk about good literature. Like, for real.
Yeah.
Lots of good literature.
I'm proud also of our network. Talk
about Marvel books. You actually sort of made me kind of care about Marvel for 30 seconds, which I normally don't.
Well, as of tonight, we're recording this the night before our second episode on Infinity War is about to drop. This one is about the Pope's encyclical. I'm calling it Thanos versus Francis. And so this is about Laudato Si. And so, yeah, if
people picked up that Marvel secretly like crypto Catholic propaganda.
Maybe so. I think Kristen Filipic has actually. So, yeah, she's been on.
Thanos is a Malthusian and he's a jerk.
He's a bad man.
Yeah, I actually judge people by if they say Thanos. Like, there's a lot of people like, Thanos isn't wrong. And I'm like,
lots of people would disagree with you. Yes, that's true.
I know. I know a lot of people would disagree with me.
No, not you. The person who says Thanos isn't wrong. So I think Derek's right. If you go to our network, the Christian Humanist, if christianhumanist.org, you'll find links to
all of them are good.
All of them are good. The flagship, the Christian Humanist podcast, started it all, spun off into the Christian Feminist podcast, which does great stuff. Book of Nature, you know, not as frequent as we'd like them to be, but they do, when they do stuff, they do great stuff. And of course, the City of Man has a really great kind of liberal versus conservative take
on it. Which is weird that I often feel like I agree with the conservative on that show more than I agree with the liberal. It makes me deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to
think. I feel like I agree with the religious liberals a little more than the Christian humanists, but like,
yeah.
I'm like,
our network will shake your foundations, right? It spins you off. Yes, I'm very proud to be affiliated. Oh, and in addition to all those kind of regular shows, what's the book one? Christian Humanist Profiles is a great selection of interviews with authors of timely books. Rod Dreher.
You got my favorite theologian on there.
Which one?
David Bentley Hart.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite Christian. He's like one of the few Christians I can like stomach.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. David Bentley Hart's
great. I mean, I don't mind N.T. Wright either, really, but.
Yeah, Nathan's gotten a chance to interview N.T. Wright a few times on that show, and it's a great collection of sort of academic theology that gets in interviews with contemporary authors, some very famous ones. And so, yeah, it's.
Maybe you guys can get David Bentley Hart and N.T. Wright to debate.
Kristen Filipic, if you're listening, let's get on this one. Derek, thank you again. This was a lot of fun to read. It's always great to talk to you. I'm going to have to find an excuse. Maybe we'll do this apocalypse show and I'll swing you into it.
That'd be the weird secular guy in the room again.
Yeah. But partially, I think I'm interested in the juxtaposition. I don't want to just talk about 88 Reasons. That might be its own episode, but I think that there's something interesting about secular visions of the apocalypse as well. And I think that that's, I'd forgotten all about Y2K, thank God. And so you reminded me of that. So maybe I'll have you back for that, yeah, but by all means.
And then also we have the Marxist Guide to All the Cool Christian Movies.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
Only half of them are Russian, the other half are Polish, but whatever. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll find a reason to have you back often.
All right, guys.
So thanks
a
lot.
Enjoyed it.
Yep. Thank you.